Hi, this is James White once again for the Solution Series brought to you by Solari.com and Corey'sDigs.com. And it just so happens my co-host for the Solution Series is the founder and editor of Corey's Digs, Corey Lynn. Corey, always great to be here with you. We have a great guest today. What do you think about the Solution Series so far, Corey? I think things are going great. A lot of great guests, and I think people are responding well.
We have had fantastic guests, so I think it's going really good. Yeah, I just got some emails today on the GridsDown comms that we just did with John Jacob Schmidt. That was a great one. And looking forward to today with our guests today.
Absolutely. And for those of you that...
Who is that?
talking about David DeBine, let me give David a proper introduction. You may have tuned into his Adapt 2030 YouTube channel and mini Ice Age Conversation podcast, where he discusses timelessness, what you can expect now through the 2024 as society resets so you can keep your family and community safe. Civilization is affected by energetic mappable cycles on Earth, and the sun repeats its 400-year cycle of low activity, affecting global crop production, the economy, and every aspect of our lives. And that's what I like so much about David DeBine is he studies cycles, and you're able to prepare people and offer solutions based upon cycles. So, David DeBine, it's great to have you here on the Solution Series.
Yeah, thank you for taking this in a different direction, because all of us, you know, we can talk to our blue in the face about the problem, and we all see the problems, this, that, and the other. I'm just simply presenting information that says we're about to go into a massive crop loss period on the natural cycle side of things based on the activity of the sun in 400-year cycles. We're back at the beginning of one, and pretty much everything you're seeing out there right now is a distraction to keep you away from understanding the natural cyclicity of all these events. So everything we're seeing out here is a dot on the map of problem, problem, problem. For me, it's a distraction to keep you away from the true understanding that it's a natural cycle, and food's going to get more and more scarce as we move through this. So then where's your solution? Where's your opportunity during these times? You know, if you go over to China, there's a saying, there's that Wei Ji, which is really two characters put together. One's danger, one's opportunity. Mm-hmm. You put those, and that's what that would mean in an overall sense. So if you break down the characters, there is danger. You're going to have that danger element. But then again, don't be afraid where it paralyzes you. It's time to take action. And then, you know, going back through history, then we know solutions that have worked prior. And that's a good thing to focus on, because you get the same fingerprints occurring when these crop loss events happen every 400 years. Population moves, the economy gets reset, and the government thinks of new ways to try to control citizenry after and during the decline. So if you already know that's in play, and you know we're from here and we're going over to here, that's great. Now, what's in the middle, and how can we stay safe, protect our families, to thrive during these times, is really what I want to get at in the solution basis here.
Fantastic. That sounds great. Absolutely. You know, there's nothing we can do about what's, you know, this natural cycle of things, like you mentioned, just like the four seasons come along. You can't stop the summer from coming, but you have to protect yourself with sunscreen, for example, to keep yourself from getting sunburned. It's that type of situation. We know that there's cycles and things are going to happen. So what we want to do is we just want to prepare folks to be ready for that. Now, David, you yourself have had kind of a unique situation, because you sort of farm yourself. And I know that you, one of our previous guests, Jim Gale, with the edible gardening, I know you're familiar with Jim, and you have done some things with him, not with him, but you have sort of adopted some of his approaches. Give us a recap, if you can, on that. It's exciting to hear about some of our previous guests, some of our future guests, unbeknownst to us, as utilizing some of the stuff we brought up previously. So give us an update on that, if you don't mind.
Now, let's start with the winter. Now, you might look at it as a disadvantage where it gets cold and everything stops growing, all the leaves fall off. Well, for me, I've been mapping out the different plant species on my property. And just like the Native American would do, they would go through, and where something was growing, like wild blueberry bushes, hazelnut bushes, wherever kind of target species you want to grow more, whether it be the turmeric that's growing wild or the lemongrass that's out there, and then trim around that during the winter time, because it's far easier to do all kind of pruning and thing, and expand the wild area for that target species you're looking for to then grow more and more and expand itself out. So my whole goal is at the end of these years and this transition we're moving through is to have a walkthrough edible forest by clearing out plants that I don't want to allow that more space for the ones I do want to grow. And that's one thing I was learning from Jim. And, he took a look at I have a huge stand of cedars at the bottom of the property. And he's like, oh, there's a whole bunch of persimmon trees in there. So over the year, why don't you just cut around, the persimmon trees? Don't cut all your trees down or the pine or the cedars, but just cut holes in them and allow that, natural lust for life to come out for those persimmon trees. And as soon as you give them space, whoosh, they're going to take off. So we're changing, and it really worked really well this year, transitioning part of that wood line back into a fruit forest line. And since I put a fence around the front 2.5 acres here, we wanted to keep our dogs in. We wanted to keep the chickens safer because we got coyotes running all over the place, natural predator problems, these sort of thing. Now I looked at it as, wow, we did the initial work for that, but we have trellises that we can roll beans and peas, that sort of thing into, because I would have to do that work myself to set out the trellises and build that scaffolding so the beans can go up. Or the peas, or whatever, nasturtiums, and any kind of thing that you think would be a growing vine up there, squash, for example. I have that perpetually now. All I have to do is replant it every year, add and build the soils along the fence line every year. And I have a natural part of my ecosystem that A, it gets more sunlight, more airflow, so you don't get the fungus and the mold that grows on a lot of plants if they're too tightly spaced. And we ran a bunch of our tomato plants up through there. And I've noticed that, I don't really grow the big tomatoes any longer. The little small cherry tomatoes of varying colors, whether they be orange or yellows or the chocolate, sort of a black colored one, really dark brown one, those thrive and they just grow right through there and they take hold. And you just go on both sides, just walk up and down. And it's a forest in itself along the fence line. And that's what I got from Jim. So he took a look at the property, gave me a couple diagrams on different species to overlay in there that are companion planting species. And then we went from there. So yeah, having talked to him and the overlay is pretty interesting how you're looking for solutions. And then both of our work has come up. And then I took his suggestions to better my property. And here I am saying, wow, it really works. It does work.
That's so cool. I actually grew pumpkins this year. I'm in a townhome, so I have very little space, and I grew some pumpkins for the first time ever, and was dealing with what you were just talking about. Like, I was getting the powdery mildew, and trying to trim the leaves and the stalks, and then and spray neem oil on them, and I'm not having great success, I gotta tell you. It's tricky. So you're saying that by your method of how you're doing it, it's allowing it to grow healthier without those issues, huh?
Well, that's all about airflow. And if
Okay.
you're going to do microgreens, which I suggest everybody buy hundreds of pounds of seeds for microgreens, because you can do that in your home as long as you have fans. And you're going to find the same thing. If you put a tray of microgreens in and you try to grow it, like for example, in here without any fans and ventilation, you're going to get that mold and fungus right away after probably 4, 5, 6 days. You're not going to be able to eat those microgreens. Wheatgrass as well, you need to water that several times a day because you're going to get that sort of like spider webby kind of mold growth on the bottom layer there doing wheatgrass. You need to water that thing like 6, 7 times a day to keep that mold, down, that like webby mold down. But again, then you got all the moisture to deal with. So they do go hand in hand. The better the airflow, the less fungus, and the more sunlight also will kill off that fungus and mold. So where do you want to place things? And like let nature do the work for you.
Right. Now, do you have? I was looking through your book and I was quickly just this morning, I was glancing through some of your solutions and I started watching the one video on winter harvest video with Elliot Coleman. That's fantastic. Do you do any of that there? Do you do like the greenhouse and then do the beds where you kind of winterize them inside the greenhouse so that you can grow all season long or?
No, because the winter garden that we've put out and are still in the process of tilling it up to get it ready for the cooler conditions, is an all outdoor grow because these plants that you're planting right now for an autumn garden, like the kohlrabi and the heavy greens, if you're looking for kales and mustard greens and these sort of things, that'll take you through the winter, dense packing a lot of micronutrients, vitamins in those deep green leaves. they're going to get that head start. We'll leave them out, and boom, as soon as spring comes, they're back up. They'll survive through. They'll grow real slow through the winter. You'll get some production out of it, some better than none. But this prime time right now, like I said, say September, October, into late November here in East Tennessee is kind of when everything really stops growing, late November. But as soon as it gets into February, that stuff takes off literally like a weed again. So we want to leave everything outdoor. Mm-hmm. Let it grow. And we just a huge bed of greens. And think about broccoli. We've switched over to broccolini instead of doing broccoli because we find that it grows much faster and it comes up in the little, once you trim those off, they just regrow themselves. But a head of broccoli doesn't really do that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these leafy greens, as the plants are growing, if you're trimming the leaf for your food source, you know, they continue to throw off leaf instead of harvesting the full plant. And that occurs during winter also. But no, this year we're going to try to overwinterize the superfoods that I've grown during the summer. I got Gynura and Moringa oleifera. Like I say, we got the lemongrasses, we got a lot of aloe veras, and that sort of thing is going to go into the greenhouse to keep it overwintered and get some starters in there too at the same time for the next planting season.
Nice.
Yeah.
How available is the seed going to be though? That's my whole thing. You know, we all understand there's economic breakdowns coming. How much seed's going to be available for the general populace? If everybody in the world wakes up in America and said, I need to go buy as much seed as I can right now.
Mm-hmm.
So get it right away.
No seed supply out there?
Get it right away is what you're saying. Buy it
right
as soon
away
as you
is
can.
Too late. Prices have doubled since last year and their availability is really down everywhere. You know, there's not very much availability like it used to be.
So one of the things that you put on the pre-interview sheet, David, that we talked about, which I thought was, you know, I had a question for you as a follow-up question. You talked about local farmers. No matter where you live, pretty much there's going to be a farmer within 10, 12, 15 miles of you probably. I mean, there's probably some exceptions, of course, but generally speaking, there'll be a farmer within, let's say, a 10-mile radius of where your house is. Here, of course, where I'm at, there's a lot more than in a 10-mile radius. What's your thoughts about meeting your local farmer ahead of time? And, you know, we talked about bartering with your farmer. How about trading like a day's worth of labor on the farm there to get a, you know, some food supply? Is that something that you think is plausible? Because there's a labor shortage right now and some places are having a hard time finding workers. Would that be something that you think, David, that would be implemented from the farmers that you know or your experiences? If you offered yourself a day's worth of labor, could you get a couple, 3-4 days worth of food for that?
Yeah, depending on what type of farm is it. Is it a fruit orchard? Are they growing veg for farmers markets, or are they running cattle or some sort of, you know, egg operation? So they're probably not going to let you into the facilities. You know, there's a couple dairies that are near here. And if you were to walk up and say that, they'd be like, sorry, this is an FDA facility. Nobody's allowed inside. By the way, take off your shoes or walk through the mat that they have there to decontaminate.
Get sprayed down.
Yeah. But if you're going on the edge of it, the easiest thing for me, now, in order of what you would want to do to try to seek these people out first, go to the farmers markets themselves and wander around and talk to people and ask if you're allowed to come out to the farm, check it out. Because you just don't want to dive in there and be like, hey, I'll offer my labor. You got to really go and check out the place first, see if you're going to sync up with them, you know, in your belief systems and whatever that entails for everybody might be a little different, or it might be really symbiosis with that belief system on how the world's changing and how the solutions are moving forward. Secondly, community gardens are a great one. And I know there's a lot of community garden projects. You can find that all over any of these social media posts and places. So then you start to get a little quiver of arrows together here of places to go. And the more that you go out there and put your hands in the soil, especially at the community garden, most of those are clued in and connected to those other farms that are out there. Now, I do want to say a caveat here. I do have people sometimes, so I should say pretty often, ask me if they want to come out and work. I would absolutely say yes almost all the time, but the trust issues these days of trying to keep some anonymity of A, your supplies, and B, your location, and you know that SecOps that are, you know, you want to keep that security as the closest to the, you know, the chest as you can. So again, you know, you get a lot of offers having a farm of people coming out, but who do you really say, yeah, come on out every weekend and that'd be great.
Everybody you would let Corey and I come out there and work.
Yeah, but see, I trust, like, I trust you all, and especially you, James. How, like, how many years have we known each other? We did the radio program together and all these things for so many years. Like, there's some trust that I was like, yeah, come on out, man. I have the keys, dude. I know you won't burn down the house and that sort of thing. But
Well,
others,
I can
you just
vouch
walk
for
up to the
Corey.
farm market
I
and go,
can
hey, I
vouch
want to
for
come out
Corey
and work
too.
for you.
Thanks, James.
You're welcome.
No, Corey, you would, see, see, here's the thing too. Like, just because of the people that I know that you know,
Right.
you would be welcome because your reputation precedes you as well with all the people who I consider like incredibly high moral characters.
Right.
Yeah, that would be like, come on out. Yeah, so and so says, yep, come on out.
Well,
But
that would
just
be
somebody to
so.
blindly knock on your door and go, hey, I want to come and work for you, and can I come out and stuff?
Right.
But they always need the labor. That's the one thing I want to say is yes, absolutely. There's always the next thing to do. We're never caught up. The list is still this big, and then tomorrow it'll be even bigger, even though we did five things.
Yeah. I once had horses, and I had a guy, just a local guy, show up. He worked with horses and trained them, and he missed them. And he did a lot of like landscape and labor work. And he said, "Hey, can I do some landscaping for you if I can just come out once a week and hang out with your horse and ride your horse?" And I said, "Sure." That actually worked out great. Those were, slightly different times back then, but yeah, no, and that would be phenomenal too to be able to go out. And like, I would love to come out there and see your place because I would learn so much, And I think doing things hands-on are so important. I think a lot of people are, preparing for different things, buying different things, stocking up on things, but then they're not taking the time to actually do them now, like to try jarring and canning, to try planting or gardening or dehydrating food or trying all these different things so that you already have the skill and the knowledge and you feel comfortable with it. So moving forward, certain things you do, is more comfortable and you're not like in this panic state. So what do you do as far as storing up for the winter? Do you do jarring or canning or do you like stock up on meat and freeze it? Or what types of things do you do to prepare for winter? Especially knowing, if they were to run into some sort of lockdown or with mass just inflation, kind of getting ahead of that.
All of the above that you mentioned. So yes, we do dehydrate, and this is the thing. We live near an Amish farm, so if we can't grow it ourselves for a lot of things. Now you have to realize in the scalability of how much energy you have and how many people you have living there, you're going to be limited on the amount you can produce. And that's just simple math. How much
Right.
labor goes in is how much produce comes out. Now you can try to grow everything, but again, you want to be an expert at something. Like for me with the cherry tomatoes, I'm trying to wire that down where I can grow those anywhere upside down. In space and up in an attic somewhere through lights, whatever. The leafy greens, okra is a no-brainer, like throwing that sort of stuff out. Oh, and also let's see, some Asian different types of vegetables that are a no-brainer also. So Kongxin Cai, morning glory is the name of that. It grows prolifically and you always need to keep trimming it, and you just get endless leaf out of that. So you want to go for the ones that have the least amount of work involved in it, but then what do you do with it once you get it? So we have a huge amount of basil plants growing. We have seven different types of basil. So the first thing I do is when it goes to flower, is I cut all those flowers and then I put them in white vinegar, and then I let that turn into a flavored vinegar with the basil flavor. Just straight white vinegar. You can get at any store. You get those big, 2 gallon things. And I try to use everything we have as a byproduct here to create another product. So the tomatoes, then we dry those and then we turn them into sun-dried tomatoes because we add our own garlic. We grow our own herbs that we put in, mainly either basil or some sort of cilantro or celery, different tastes. We have a couple different types of celeries, mainly for cooking, real small ones, not the big thick one that you think of. So we add in our own flavors in there, and then we put the olive oil in, and that allows us to store olive oil and a food source and an antibacterial as well, all in one jar. So those are all the kind of things we do. And then I'm really into the tinctures right now. On when I know there's a natural medicine benefit, we just buy the 100 proof alcohol. A lot of people call it rock gut. I went into the store to buy a whole bunch of bottles of 100 proof vodka, and they're like, you drink this? This stuff's rock gut. I was like, of course, but I want to use this for tinctures. And they're like, oh, use this one over here. It's 120. You might want to use that one. So I do everything from Everclear
Explain
all the
that
way down to
tincture. Wait, what is
100-proof
that?
to
What is that?
preserve.
Explain that to us. What's the tincture? Is that like a, do you boil something down to a smaller, to its liquid form or something, to a small, explain that if you don't mind.
Yeah, so plants and parts of the plants and the seeds of different plants, there's medicinal value in there depending on what it is. And once you put that in alcohol, it takes out the volatile compounds and the things that you want, as you know, as medicine. And that's the way they did it back in the 1800s. Almost everything. That's why medicines back then were bitter and that they were broken down and taken out as a tincture. That's why people would always add, hot water to it to thin it out, if you will. So, like goji berries, which is a superfood, goji berries and Chinese apple. So, if you put those two together in like a quart jar and fill it full alcohol and let it sit there, you have a superfood liquid drink. So, if you really start to get sick, you want to put that one into your system. And then there's just so many of them that I've been learning so much. And the different kind of mushrooms. We had some reishi mushroom up here, so even mushroom tinctures, and then also the wild lettuce to boil that down. We were doing that more with a rice cooker. And how do you store those things at the end once you get your product done? So then you need to preserve it somehow. But if you're going to preserve it, in alcohol is the best way, and then you can preserve it for years and years and years. So you start with your quart jars, and then once you siphon it or once you filter it off, and I use usually just coffee filters, obviously non-chlorine based, but the brown paper coffee filters to remove any kind of debris out of there. And then I just put it in little black glass tincture bottles. And that's a medicine that I'm making myself, like calendula, and there's all these different ones that are out there to be used for either salves, balms, like using jewelweed and tobacco mixed with the bee wax for poison ivy. I mean, this is old Native American cures when you mix these together, and turning things into salves by using beeswax, but then also using the alcohol for the tinctures. And James, I think you'd seen my back shelf back there in the front.
Yeah.
I'll send you some images of it. It's loaded with everything that we store, including beans, all the things we dehydrate. It's all in glass, and it's all meant to store for a long time. So using alcohol, having a dehydrator, you're gonna have two. We broke one. The motor just went out, and luckily we had a backup, and we were just continued to go. And then I bought another two because two is one and one is none, and three is better because once it breaks, you'll still have two.
Right on, yeah.
Yeah, and then the supply chain's breaking down. You're not going to be able to get this stuff. And I'm serious, by 2023 middle, you are not going to be able to buy a dehydrator if your life depends on it, because that supply chain, whatever's in there now, once it runs its course, there will be nothing coming for 5 to 10 years after that until things start
Here's another
ruining.
thing, that brings up another point, David, that I wanted to bring up with you. Garden tools. We know that
Same.
when everybody realizes that it's time to start gardening, there's going to be a run on garden tools, and there may be a shortage of garden tools, most likely will. What are going to be the key garden tools that, I mean, right now, before the pressure hits, and if you've got some extra money, what garden tools? Obviously, you're going to want a shovel, you're going to want a rake, but what are going to be the key garden tools that you're going to need, sort of as you're working through your solutions after, in the worst case scenario, or something happens where the power goes out or something like that?
Well, just like me and Corey sitting here, different tools, different sizes. Like there's men's tools and women's tools. And I like the rakes, especially the women's rake, a little bit not so heavy, but they're smaller. For me, I like to get, because we grow a lot of stuff in pallets, like shipping pallets. We rip out the center wood, and then we quarter it out, and then you can grow a specific species in there. And there's really very so easy to you don't get very many weeds compared to growing it in a garden where you're always weeding. Putting in a shipping pallets the way we grew it just put so much extra time in our pockets by not having to weed.
You
But
mean
then
just
in
the wooden
between those
pallets?
rows, those
Hold
smaller
on, hold on. You
rakes.
mean just
Yeah,
the
go
wooden
ahead.
pallet? The wooden pallet? You mean like the wooden pallets you buy, like that they put in the back of a grocery store? Just those wooden
Yeah, did you
pallets?
see? He sent us the pictures. Did you see those?
I have the picture here, but I didn't open it yet.
Yeah, they're in the picture. I was looking at that thinking, huh, that's a
Ah,
pallet.
there we
That's
are.
very
There you
cool.
go. I got it right now. Yeah, I'll include these pictures. We will. I'll pop those pictures in during this portion of the show. Very good. Wonderful.
Yeah, you can drop those in anywhere. So, people always think a garden has to be some super giant thing. No, it has to be the size. And if you really want to squeak it in there and have it, really ergonomic and not in the way of anything, just put a shipping pallet in there and break it off. And you can do it in half, where half of the pallet is one species and the other half is another. Like we run a lot of lettuces. Like right now is a great time to start growing lettuce. Cool in the mornings, nice sun in the afternoons. In the summertime, you can't grow lettuce. It just rips it up. It's too hot. But right now is a good time. And in those pallets, like lettuce is amazing because it just grows so well.
And that's deep enough for the soil for the root system.
To use pretty much the box and then the divider on the top. So it's empty on the bottom that actually goes into the soil.
Gotcha.
And
Okay.
we churned it all up and then added a whole bunch of, mycorrhizae and kelp and what else do we put in? Calcium, we bunch of busted up oyster shell and a few other things in there, worm castings. And then we mulched it, got that soil really nice, threw a bunch of mulch in there to give it some fluffiness. And then we put those shipping containers on top. So when it does go, it can continue to grow down if it wants to.
Nice. Nice. Now,
Yeah, I'm flashing this. I'm flashing
Oh,
the
wait, so I
pictures.
didn't answer your question. I'm sorry, James. I got on that tangent there. Sometimes I do. If I do it, stop. But this, what I'm saying is, well, Corey would maybe use a smaller amount of smaller tools than I would. So if you're going to be raking all day long, are you going to want something heavier? You're going to want something lighter. So if you're looking at those, look at plastic rakes, look at different size of rakes. Not all rakes are the same. Some have bigger teeth, some have more rounded teeth that aren't digging as much into the soils. So for me, I think I got six or seven different kind of rakes already. And that would be the same with shovels as well. Some of these long cylindrical shovels, so you can dig that real nice smooth hole. A post hole digger as well, you need that because we found the wine vines that we put along the fence on the one side, we found it planted way, way easier by using a post hole digger to get that perfectly round because they come in the round wrapping anyway. And bloop, just drop them right in. Different kinds of shovels. You're going to need long shovels. You're going to need those wide spades, but you're also going to need really tinier stuff that's still long enough to use with the foot. But then when you get down on your knees there, you're going to need a whole bevy of hand tools that are small shovels and the ones with the three, with the rakes, with the small, I forget the name of it. It's got three tongs on it or tines on it where you pull and you can move soil around. So you're going to have to scale it from small while you're down there, actually into the plant itself, working the dirt and the soil, into scaling it where you're preparing the soils, and some things in between because the women's tools have smaller handles. So,
Right.
there's actually a category of women's tools, and it's far, they're lighter and the handles are smaller, and it's meant for women working outside that are not going to be doing the super heavy, strenuous, moving 6 tons of dirt with a shovel kind of stuff, more into the finesse and the fine-tuning end of it. So a pitchfork also, definitely. I got two different types of pitchforks. One's really tight together with the forks, and the other one's what you consider like mom and pop kettle holding that one. There's always, once you do a lot of cleaning, there's always going to be a huge amount of grasses and debris and clippings and stuff. So it's way easier to just hit that with a pitchfork and throw it onto a tarp. Oh, and tarps too. I mean, I would stack tarps to the ceiling because they break all the time and you're just going through an endless supply of tarps. And right now, again, that's all that stuff made in China. So if you can find any of that stuff tarps wise, get it while you can. And also another nugget is estate sales. Now you can find these estate sales listed anywhere across the listings on a, choose your social media platform, choose your community newspaper. But I'm telling you what, the people who bought those tools in the 1950s and 60s, that steel that is used now, it's so different on the tool quality, and you just have to repair the handles mainly.
Right,
So
you're right about that.
you're going to find a handle maker. Luckily, there's one guy here who makes hickory handles. So I go in and I buy like 10 handles, and people, just like wrap them up. They're cylindrical, they're handles. Buy as many handles as you can, and I assure you that turning a handle by to make it into a handle, that I can't even believe how much work that is. But even to sharpen it down so it comes to that sort of lobe point where it'll actually fit back into the tool again, that's a little skill set in itself on how you need to sand it off to get it to fit back in the tools and how to secure it with either nails or lug nuts and screws. I don't know. 1860 is where we need it. Oh, and I have some hand scythes also. I got two stand-up hand scythes and a bunch of small little ones to get in between weeds. And also, I have one of those push mowers that you had in the 1940s or whatever, where it's no motor. It's just a one
I
that
have one
looks
of those
like
too. Yep,
it.
one of the
Yeah,
you
like
know,
these are the kind of things you're gonna need.
one of those came up on, you know what, believe it or not, one of those came up on one of those social media for sale things, and it was like $30 for this push mower, no motor, and I said, bam, I got to go get that because you know, I sharpen the blades and it's ready to go.
Did you? I watched a couple of YouTube videos on how to do that, where they showed you how to run it backwards and use some kind of gel in there, and then buff it up, oil the wheels, and you're ready to go again.
Yeah, I
Now,
agree.
speaking of tarps, what are the tarps called that you use specifically for covering, for covering plants, the for
A row
winterizing?
crop, row crop, row covering, or row crop covering.
Row crop covering. Okay.
Yeah, it's kind of like a skim. If you're going to use over light, sometimes you'll put like some white. It's rather thin, and also from our own experience, I'll save you the trouble of ruining your row crop. Like, we would use bamboo poles and then attach the pepper plants, because you saw some of those images. Those pepper plants are as tall as I am now. But in the beginning of the year, we had some nasty storms blow through here. I mean, way out of the like 60-mile-an-hour winds, so we put the row cover over everything because we didn't want it to get damaged last year about this time with the early frost coming in. And the bamboo had, with all the wind action, just ripped holes. So everywhere when we looked out, it was like 40 holes going up through the row cover of where the bamboo had punctured through all that row cover.
Oof.
So anytime, yeah, and then we thought, okay, well, let's just use a pot and then put it over. And that way there's no stick to actually rub on anything. So we learned, if you're going to do it, get a whole bunch of plastic flower pots and make sure you cover that so there's no stick protruding, and then you can lay it over.
That said, bamboo is the bomb. I always keep bamboo sticks around. I've used them for curtains, curtain
Yeah, you
rods. I
can keep
mean,
those
they're
things
just,
forever.
I know, they're very handy. You know what? One of my concerns I would love to get your thoughts on is soil, right? I mean, most people who are not farmers or homesteaders, they go to their local hardware store, they buy bags of soil that says it's good for vegetables and flowers and this and that. And most people just don't know a whole lot about soil. And I realize we can YouTube videos and all of that, not to give kudos to YouTube who just nuked me, but so what can people do? Let's say you don't have access to that. And you need to just work with what you have on your land, and you need to get your soil working good for you. What types of things can you just do with what you have at home, or simple products you might, be able to get ahead of time in store for that?
Yeah, I would get a book, JADAM, Jadam. And it's a
Okay.
method on how you use household waste, as in like the rice you were going to throw away, or something that has starches in it, like an old pancake, for example, and how you put this into water and you get the fungus to grow in there, the positive fungi. So then you can then, after 7 to 10 days of brewing this batch, then have your own soil building microbes to add directly into the soil. And that really costs pennies. I mean, how much does it
Right.
cost for a bag of rice? Then to throw some sugar in a bucket and aerate it for 2 weeks, and then strain it off, and then get your batch of like basically EM to be able to start the soils to grow it. Because this is the thing, like, the realization is going to set in for a lot of people that, like James said there, we need to go get garden tools. Okay, maybe you're the lucky one and you get there and you can buy a bunch. Farm Co-op, by the way, is another place to go to. If your local, like, Home Depot is out of stuff, just go to the Farm Co-op. They have a lot more stuff there for farmers. So they're extra stocked in tools many times in the beginning of the season. Not so much now, almost everything's bought out. But then they want to dig in, and then they're like, all right, I want to plant something. I want to plant a garden. And then they run into, oh, it's 100% clay here. Now what? Oh, I thought it was that easy. I thought all I did was put seeds in and add water and we got food.
Right.
Yeah, not like that at all. I'm not even an expert. I shouldn't even be talking about it. I've only been doing it, what, 3 years or 2.5 years to try to build the soils that you see in those gardens that I have pictures of, to try to get those soils healthy enough that that level of production can come out of that space. It's taken me years to get there.
It looks great, man.
Yeah.
I mean, these are huge vegetables you got going on. They look awesome. I want to have a
Yeah.
salad, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, well, and again, we always have enough. We never buy any leafy greens or any of those kind of tomatoes or peppers or any of that kind of stuff, or I was thinking chokwe. I'm thinking the Chinese name of the okra and all these kind of things. We have never ending amounts of that kind of fresh vegetable for stir fries, and so that's all taken care of. even the broccolini and those broccoli type things, just when you get up into meat, do you start to have a problem of where does your meat source come from? You know, protein source like that. But building the soils, you know, if you can save all your leaves this year, and I'm trying this now, and I've already made a fair few piles from last year, and they have broken down pretty good. So what I did, you know, I'm living in a forest. I got 20 some acres out here, and I've only cleared, or it's only 6 acres is not forest. So got, you know, 12 acres plus of forest land. Now to blow all these leaves with a blower into a certain spot and then ring them in and then let that decompose and break down. There you have some humus that you can start using to then put into your garden. Or if you didn't do that, you can wander through the forest and then through that thick leaf layer. If you dig down in there, you're going to get to that what looks like a little spider webby stuff down there. That's like the positive fungus mold that you need, that bacteria to go rocking in your garden and start breaking down and then building that soil. So, I mean, it's free. You just need to wander around the forest and dig down through the layers of the top leaves to get that leaf humus and even take the first quarter half inch of soil on that too and start using that to build on top of after whatever. You could lay some straw. A lot of people I've seen out here, so let's say you want to have a foot deep bed. Well, they'll dig down like a foot and a half or maybe even a little bit deeper, and they'll lay a bunch of logs and sticks at the bottom to fill up that space, and then that decomposes over time and holds moisture as well. And that's like a pretty hardy thing that'll take a couple years to break down. And then they layer it on top with straw, and then they come into the forest humus. And then what you're talking about, finally, the very top layer is that stuff you buy from Home Depot or whatever hardware garden center. That's the top layer of what they're using to grow. Because you see how they, and then they're always adding microbes and these sort of thing and mycorrhiza and the forest humus inside to get this live, living, building soil that continues to regenerate. Not a lot of people get that concept. And to go from, I never gardened before to, wait, the world just fell apart, but I got a shovel. That's a huge thing to for people to digest. You know, how is the awareness psychologically going to move in with this whole, you know, food growing thing? I don't have that answer. I
Well,
don't.
David, let me bring this up. So you talk about that forest, about digging through the leaves. So the time to do that would be at the end of the fall season, obviously, after all the leaves have fallen, and you can go out into the forest. There's a lot, depending upon where you live, there's a lot of woods or forest, brown heathers especially. Will that store, because usually you don't plant again until the spring. Can you take that layer and can you store it somewhere, like in a container, or will it stay good if you just put it in a cool dry place over the winter? How do you maintain that, or do you have to use it right away?
No, you would throw it in the place that you're going to plant because it's soil also, and it's another it's soil. So when you the layers up there are you can get that at any time of the year, just depending on how dig, because the humus is pretty thick, at least here in East Tennessee. That layer goes down a good half foot, a good 6 inches down that you can harvest at any time. But if you want to make your own compost tea or your own leaf mulch, you just need to keep piling those leaves in a certain place and keep getting them wet, and nature will do that for you. It'll knock it down, knock it down, knock it down, and then you'll see at the end of the year the big super giant pile that kids used to jump in has turned into kind of a flat mass by the end of the year. And generally, you need about 12 months to get that to go from what you consider this year's leaf dropping on the forest floor to picking up hundreds and hundreds of pounds of those and trying to keep crushing them down, crushing them down, and then I don't even put it in a bin. There's a kind of a natural, I wouldn't even, it just kind of, and there's a natural dip in the forest up in not too far from here. So I just go up and throw as many leaves, as much stuff as I can get anytime. I just keep loading it in there, loading it in there, loading it in there, and I let nature do it for me. So it is a soil already. So to preserve it, as you're talking about, you don't want to dehydrate it. I mean, you could, they would go dormant, but I would just take it and put it in the same spot that I want to grow next year and just keep layering that there and getting my beds pre-season. And then when it is time to plant, just with a rototiller, again, who has access to a rototiller? You're going to want that. Doing it by hand is difficult, but then just mulch all that in there and then, you know, any of the soil adjuvants that you want to toss in as well. So from zero to being able to get that humus by yourself as a, I'm starting today to create leaf mulch 1 year. But you can go into the forest at any 1 second and just spread apart leaves and dig out that. It smells real earthy too. And by the way, fulvic minerals come from that. I had a really good interview with Clive DeCarl over in the UK, and he was telling me all about fulvic minerals. And I don't know. I
Never
didn't
heard of
know
them.
about fulvic minerals, right? And he's like, well, it comes from soil forest humus. And if in a rudimentary way, if you want to be able to do that and then distill that down and let that soak in the water and do the purification process, you can get your own fulvic minerals out of a forest, or you can go where there's veins of fulvic minerals already compressed for you, like they are in the UK. There's real dense stuff over there that they harvest and mine
And you
out,
can eat that
but
way. Is that for your body, human consumption, or is that for planting only? Can you actually,
both.
really,
Both.
you can drink a tincture from the forest floor, and it's healthy for you in certain cases.
Yeah, but it requires a little processing. I'm not going to go out and get a handful of dirt, throw it in a cup, and then
Of
drink
course
it. No,
not, David. Of
that's
course
asking
not.
for problems there.
I know that. I know this. I know this.
That's not advice. Please do not. Please do
So,
not put a cup in your hand and drink it.
I actually have a distiller. So, how would you take something like that? Is that what you're saying? You would actually like put it in? I have, a big pot, a big distiller, and so I'm just trying to visualize how you would do that, taking it from the.
Okay, so you go down, and again, you need to scrape. Now, this is not medical advice. This is just what I heard from a person who does the production of fulvic minerals that sells it. And then, in the rudimentary way, and we were describing going back in time thousands of years, like how did animals and people get these base nutrients back into our bodies? Well, they would take the forest floor and you move all the leaves away, you scrape off the top layer, and then you want to get down into the deepest, richest compost that you can. And what you want to do is then put that into the water, and then you're going to let it sit there. And you're going to let that come out of solution. You're going to heat it up a little bit, depending on what time of the year, but you don't want it definitely anywhere near boiling. You want it to come up to maybe like 120 degrees. You want to let that sit. And then once that settles, then you want to do several different batches of straining that off. Like the mineral compounds are going to be then in the water solution. They'll come out in the water.
Very
And at
cool.
that point, it's just about taking the contaminants out of either the forest debris itself or any microbe or pathogen bacteria that's in there, and removing that. And literally, you're drinking. Basically, if you had a big tea bag of forest floor and you dipped it in water enough, and you could remove all the microbes that wouldn't make you sick, that's pretty much the idea of what you're getting at.
And what's the advantage of these? What kind of minerals are these called again?
Fulvic,
Fulvic.
FULVIC.
And why are they, and I hate to sound like an idiot, but I mean, I've never heard of them before.
No, I didn't either.
Why are they better than other minerals? What is with the fulvic minerals that makes them special? Do you know that?
Well, if you're looking at your body as a full organism, like what kind of minerals, salts, and vitamins does your body need to continue to thrive? So if you step back into the animal kingdom, you always find animals at these fulvic mineral deposits licking, scraping, and ingesting. Why is it that they always go there? Why do the deer always, the simplest thing, why do they come and lick the salt? Well, they're there for the minerals. But at the same thing, the animal kingdom revolves around having these same fulvic minerals that they seek out, that they just know instinctively that it's something that if they ingest, their body will function better.
Wow, that's great stuff.
And it's a full range. It's not just one, but our bodies are so depleted of so many things. Like throwing magnesium back into your body would probably be one of the best things to get you back healthy. Again, not medical advice. I'm just saying, read some peer-reviewed research, and they were saying that the number one thing that most bodies are lacking of minerals, and magnesium would be at the top of the list. And if that gets put back in good proportion, then everything else starts to function more correctly. And the same thing with the fulvic mineral. Once those get put back in, the balance starts to rearrange itself.
And a couple other things that would be important items for people to get would be like ball jars and Mylar bags for storing. And as far as storing goes, whether you have a small garden or a homestead, or maybe you don't have access, maybe you don't have that set up yet at all, and you're going to your local farmers, what do you recommend? What do you do for winter? If you're trying to prepare, I realize people can buy, buckets full of rice and whatnot, but to get nutrients and vegetables and fruits and herbs and whatnot, how do you recommend someone go about, what do you think would be the smartest things to get to store for the winter? And, what are you jarring for that? And I'm always curious about shelf life because I hear different things on that,
Yeah, I'm a shelf life investigator myself, and I really believe that that is the key to really thriving there in this time, and knowing what the healthy foods will be and what expiration date. And some things never go bad, like honey. If it's truly honey from a source that they just take the caps off, spin it in the centrifuge, and then you get the honey. As long as it's not heated and boiled and all that pasteurized, it's good forever. They go back to some of these Hittite tombs 5,000 years ago, and what we know, Petra would be probably the most famous area in Jordan. That whole empire, the Hittite Empire, they have found things stored in mushrooms that is still good after 5,000 years. So, you look at some of these things that honey, for sure, you're going to need. Now, tea and coffee, those are things that you're going to want to have. Also, squashes, pumpkins, gourds. These types of things are so easy to store. I've had them last up to 8 months over the winter, of course, because it's a little bit cooler. But the key to storing pumpkins, and this is old timer knowledge. Everything I've ever learned is from the old timers telling me this, or the Amish guys. If you have a rack out in your garage, for example, because garages generally stay cooler or sometimes freeze, but you don't want your fruit or melons to freeze completely. You want to keep them in a cool place. But the problem is, if they're resting against wood or let's say plastic in a box or a crate, they're going to start to mold and get decomposition on the side wherever it's touching. So the secret is put some straw down there, and it lays on the bed of straw, but don't let the pumpkins or your melons or your gourds or your squash touch each other. So you got to leave a little space between and put them on a bed of straw, and they will stay good for 8 months, 9 months, easy.
Nice.
You mean pumpkins
That's
you
a
can
good
just buy
point.
from a store today? You can buy it from a store that they're, because they're selling pumpkins a lot in the grocery stores right now, a lot of them. You can just take one of those pumpkins out of right from the shelf and just put it right there on the straw, and it'll last for 8 months.
Yeah, and it depends on how much the stem will rot away too. And like some of these store-bought ones have been chemically treated as well. So, it's good to know the source of your pumpkins. Like our pumpkins we get from the Amish, all kind of pumpkins. They got the white ones, the blue ones, the regular like jack-o'-lantern pumpkins. They got different kind of squash. They got different kind of butternut squash, zucchini squash, all these things. Any of those will store properly if it's on the straw. Now, the thing you're going to find with the pumpkins that I found last year was the rot will start down the stem somewhere, probably most. And then immediately when you start to see any kind of white or, mold, something like this on the stem, you're going to immediately need to use that one and get it away from the rest of them. But a lot of your target, if you keep checking this, like just wander through once a week and see if any of the stems are starting to show some signs of rot. That's where it will come first. But yes, you can literally store pumpkins indefinitely. Well, I would say indefinitely, but through the winter time, putting them on a shelf on straw. Store-bought ones, I would say yes, but just make sure they don't have the chemical on them.
Now,
Yeah.
what if you wanted to cut one of those open and cube it up and jar it? How do do you ever do it like that and preserve it in that manner?
I have learned so far. I hear a lot of people say canning, canning. Like my idea of jarring up something in a ball jar canning is like bulk beans, and we'll get the 1/2 gallon jars and put it in. We canned a bunch of tomatoes last year. It is an enormous amount of work. I mean, an enormous amount of work. So we found dehydrating was a faster way to achieve some of the same end, where we can then rehydrate some things. I know making, spaghetti sauces and that sort of, red tomato sauces is going to be a little bit different than trying to reconstitute dried tomatoes, et cetera. But tomato pastes work really well. If you're looking for stocking stuff up, you can find like quartered tomatoes, have tomatoes that are in halves already and cans. The paste is really good. But if, because we only have so much time, and it takes an enormous amount of time to can, an enormous amount of time. And some of our jars popped open at the end where I don't know why the seals weren't that good or what happened, but we lost a couple. They just popped open. Storing that stuff, like, my wife was always saying, let's eat fresh while we got fresh. And then if we need to, we can eat. So every time we get something, instead of going for the canned food and then taking the new stuff that we have, we'll always try to eat fresh first. And then if we have to use something, then we will. But to put a huge amount of pumpkin, it's just better to freeze it.
Yeah.
And juices too, they save really well. If you're able to get a bunch of fruit and you're like, well, that's too much space in my freezer, then juice it and then freeze that juice. Yeah, it's a safe space. Because the things that we're looking at right now, a lot of what I've been looking for specifically here. Now, I wrote a note here. Cheesecloths. Like get miles of cheesecloth. Because whenever you're going to squeeze something out, after you do a process with it, you're going to want to keep all the debris and just get the good stuff out. So cheesecloths. And then also coffee filters. Like I say, you don't want any of that bleached one. You want the brown paper coffee filters. That way you can run anything through and remove the debris.
Right. And that comes in handy for a lot of different things. But let me just ask you real quick, the difference between a dehydrator versus a freeze dryer. And do you have both?
No, I just have dehydrators. Freeze dryer, expensive, almost impossible to find now. Really way more expensive. I'm shooting myself in the foot. I should have got one last year. But I was thinking, do I want to spend $4,000 on a freeze dryer? But now I'm looking, going, they're not even available. I probably should have bought that. But in terms of bang for your buck and the amount of time that you have spent to get ready, you're going to spend 50 hours canning. If you're talking at the level you want to do with pumpkins to get all that ready, you're going to spend, days prepping it, drying it, preparing it, boiling it, getting it ready. Then you got to, put it in the jars, and then you got to, boil all those and get them and let them rest and all this stuff. Canning's a huge operation. That's why families did it together. And the more I go back in history, I realize that a lot of this stuff that we talk about so casually, like you're going to go canning.
Right.
That was a family affair. Like 15 people got together to knock anything out on a weekend. That's how much work it is.
Yeah. The only thing I've done with jarring at all was making jams. And that in itself was a little time consuming. But what brand dehydrator do you recommend?
Oh, geez. Nelco was a good one. Then both of the Nelcos have outlasted the other. What was the other one? It was just weird. Here's the one thing. I forget what brand it was. Westinghouse or something. It was a round one. And if we thought, oh, that's cool. You could stack them and stack them. Thing was, when we were drying all these tomatoes, the juice would fall down. And generally on a food dehydrator, you could wipe the entire plate clean on the bottom layer. There was where the fan was coming out, and you couldn't even separate it. I had to actually take the screws out of it to finally get behind there. And it was just a mess. I mean, poor design. So we never bought another one. Nelco, it's kind of a square one. And what we found is if you continually buy the same brand and your motor breaks, you still have the trays.
Right.
And then you can start. Yeah. Then you start stacking more trays, and you could turn your heat down a little bit longer, but then you could dry 10, 12 trays of something easier, like basil leaves and different kind of leafy things.
You can buy, I paid $100 for an air fryer, and it has a dehydrating feature on it. And it's got racks. Okay, It's even got a couple. You can't fit a lot in there, but you could dehydrate, some jerky, a couple, a bag full maybe. So even that's only cost $100, and that is pretty much would fit in most people's budgets, I think. And you're not going to be able to do, bulk dehydrating, but if you just do a little bit each day, eventually it's all going to add up.
Yeah, and see, now please don't think about it doing each day. It is a lifestyle that you're doing consistently through the time when there's abundance. So if you think you're going to wait until the end of September and buy all this stuff up at the market and dehydrate it and can it right now, that's not the way it works. I'm sorry. It could for some, if you have the labor pool around you to help you do that at one time. But from the spring, when our basil started to come in and the cilantro and the different spices that we had, when that started to come in, we would continuously pick it, dry it, dehydrate it, powderize it, and then put it up. And it's been like that continuously through the summer for everything. So now we have a nice little stash, but it's just continuous motion. It wasn't like rush and get it all done at the end of the year. It was, take the extra bounty and harvest. Like I have a lot of different vinegars now. I got six good solid types of different vinegars from the different basil flowers. And I've been letting that sit there for like 2-3 months in some cases, 6 months in others. Some of the alcohol steeps for the tinctures has been, like 8 months. So I know almost everything's out of there now. I'll use a cheesecloth and then strain all those goji out of there. The thing is, you got to incorporate it into your lifestyle. If you think it's going to be like, I'm just going to continue to live my life and then I'm going to pop in for 5 minutes at harvest season and then store enough food for the rest of the year for me,
Right.
it just doesn't work that way. And Corey, you just said right. So, you know, what are you?
Oh yeah. Yeah. It is. It's a lifestyle. Let me ask you this. What are your top herbs you would say for herbs or plants for medicinal purposes that you think would be wise ones for people to start growing for medicinal?
Definitely the echinaceas and the elderberries, those sort of things that are known antivirals as well as the garlic, but you got to plant the garlic in the winter to get it to come up. So there's a few tricks to that. The onions, we're always going for the spring onions. Calendula, that's an easy one to grow. I mean, any of that kind of thing. I've been experimenting, I haven't done it yet, but I've just been experimenting with the marigolds, African really dark orange marigolds, because you can make a tincture antibiotic out of those. And if you boil down the heads and then, you know, like you're talking about slow boil it, and then you finally get that syrupy at the bottom there, then you harvest that off. That is an antibacterial. Again, as long as you don't go over a certain temperature range, you'll still have that. Like things that we've used through the past. Like if your grandma was going to say something like, we always grew XYZ. What are the old grandmas telling? What did every grandma have in their garden? They always had like chamomile for upset stomachs for the teas. They always had echinacea growing. They always had elderberries. And lucky enough, we have wild blueberries. So I would be growing blueberries as well, antioxidants. And anything that you could get as a vitamin C source as well. And if you're going to be talking about micronutrients and using your food as your medicine, then you know it takes it into a whole different level. Basils for sure, spearmints, peppermints, these kind of mint plants. You only need one pot. I mean, you're really not going to run through that much peppermint in a year. I mean, yeah, it's great to grow it, and you got the chocolate peppermint and you got the regular green that we, but in reality, we only ever used a tiny bit of peppermint and spearmint and thing. But those are in seed packs that you can just buy online right now, which I would highly suggest to anybody to get like a t the 12 pack of just the most common seeds. You literally throw them out and your garden comes up. But those are some of my top choices that I would think that easy to prepare, incredibly easy to identify, and huge, like Himalayan sized mountains of information on how to prepare it across the internet and how to use it. So you got to have all three. You got to have the info on how to prepare it. Don't go for some weird, like obscure specie of thing.
David, as we're coming down here towards the end of the interview, I'd like to ask you one final question. What could would you let people know as far as the best high density nutritional foods to store for the winter? People that are on, you know, a low budget, they don't have gardens, they don't have acreages to grow stuff. They have to go to their local grocery store or the farmer's market. What can they get that the highest density, most nutrient rich food that they can get that lasts them through the winter before we go ahead and wind things down?
Nuts, dried fruits, butters, peanut butters, almond butter, anything like this. And also the oils. If you get avocado oils, olive oils, these things have an enormous amount of, you know, fat burning content in there, a lot of energy density in it. Because that's the thing. Okay, the protein's one thing, but the energy, the calorific value that's included in the foods. So run through the nuts, and anything that's a nut that you can eat as a hard nut has also pretty much been made into a butter. And those are not very expensive in the stores. Might be the double price or something of this equivalent to the price of a jar of peanut butter. But if you're getting almond butter or cashew nut butter, you know, that's something on a level step up there. The beans, there's different types of beans, and the density of, you'll have to do the research yourself, but black-eyed peas for us grow really well. So if you want to do a holistic circle on it, if you get a store-bought bag of beans, you could actually turn those into microgreens in your garage or in your house. Like most of those beans, if you put them in a tray, a flat tray, put some soil, pack it down, and just barely cover that, water them, you're going to get a whole tray of microgreens. And by the way, microgreens from black-eyed peas are the most supple, sweet. They're very close to sunflower on the texture of the snappiness and things. So if you're thinking about just calorific density or that same as a storable that you could turn into another product, then you start linking levels up here, like beans, you can boil them for a stew, you can microgreen them, you can You know, there's a lot of ways to look at it.
Let me get this straight. So you're saying you can go buy store-bought black eyed peas, take like a baking pan, lay them along the bottom of a baking pan, put soil over top of them and water them, and they'll bring up micronutrients that will pop out through the soil?
Yeah, a little bit different fashion than that. You definitely want to have some holes at the bottom. So you can get those, you know, rectangular black trays that are made for mowing, growing microgreens or starters for like 80 cents, a dollar, let's say. And then you put your soil in there first, and then you pack it down with like a piece of wood or something, just so not like iron, you know, concrete hard, but pack it down enough. Then you lay your beans on top of that, and then you cover those with some soil at the end. So you want the first base layer probably, you know, a couple inches deep. And you could use that store-bought stuff too. Just dig it out of the bag, put it right in there, tamp it down, make it, and then put your beans in there, and then put a quarter inch of dirt over the top of that and just water it. Make sure it's not overwatered, but you know, once a day to check on it. And boom, yeah, you're right. An entire tray will come up, and they are so delicious, these greens.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
I've sprouted a huge amount of stuff before, like chickpeas, terrible. Don't even waste your time. But you're going to get this stringy mess that's just unedible. Huh. Black-eyed peas, and they're super cheap. Pinto beans, pretty easy. I've never had, you know what I'll tell you? I'll save you the trouble. I've never had good luck with black beans or the red beans. Forget, waste your time on those two. Go for something that's a no-brainer. Black-eyed peas, pinto beans, to grow those up as microgreens.
David, very cool. David, good stuff, man. We appreciate you taking the time here.
Folks, I could go for another hour.
Yeah, I know. There's always so many things to talk about. This is great, David. Really appreciate you taking time out here.
I'm sorry, James. Can I cut you off for one? Can I say just one last thing?
Sure, go ahead. Of course.
Like everything I'm telling you and explaining to you, I never knew how to do before. I had to learn it. So now I learn it. Now I know what I'm doing. So I'm perfecting my skill every step of the way. Like for me, everything that I've, you know, growing the microgreens, I didn't know how to. Canning up things, you know, reading about how to put basil flowers in vinegar to get a flavored vinegar. I didn't know how to do that. I experimented with it and I did it and it worked out. I'm like, wow, now I can replicate it. So if you're looking at this and go, man, that guy's, it's a mountain of information. There's just no way I can, you know, understand and do all that stuff that this guy's doing or talking about. You can. That's the whole message, is you can. I learned it. Anybody else can learn it too. And it's just about putting your fingers in the soil and actually doing it so you can learn it. Because when you do it, you remember it.
Well, and it's rewarding and gratifying in so many ways too, you know, so you get excited and enthusiastic about it and just try one thing at a time, you know.
Those are great. Those are great words. That's great, David. I agree. Yeah. You know, even if you fail, you've at least
you're learning.
Yeah. You're learning right on.
Yeah, I learned what not to do.
Exactly.
David,
now, where can people find
you? Yeah. I was just going to say, David, tell us where people can find out more about you.
Well, the Revolution Radio now, by the way, we're streaming on 8 different platforms, Thursday night, 10 p.m. to midnight on Studio A Revolution Radio. Trying to get that more of a live format, uncensored over there, but we do stream out on 8 different platforms. And the Adapt 2030 channel, which you can find anywhere, you know, you can go BitChute, Brighteon TV, which I have my own show there on 2 to 3 p.m. on Fridays with Mike Adams there. And then Brighteon.com, where I have all my regular Adapt 2030 videos. I'm up on Rumble, YouTube, obviously, any other platforms that people post some of my stuff. And then the podcast, the Mini Ice Age Conversations podcast. Again, anywhere podcasts are hosted across the net, because there's so many venues that you can listen, but it auto-populates out to 14 or 15 different venues. So if you look for the podcast or the videos, they're pretty easy to find up on any search engine that you would use.
And you got a book too, right? And where can people find your book?
Well, I haven't updated the book since it was written back, prior to the COVID. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of information that really needs to be updated in the book. It's called Climate Revolution, and the solutions are still valid in there. But the information up to what we've seen for the earth changes and the exponential increases needs to be updated. Like, that was then, this is now. We have some good base data now where it's going to go from here.
David Dubai, we appreciate you joining us here today on the Solutions Series, brought to you by Solari.com and Corey'sDigs.com. This is a great episode, folks, and you can just go to Solari.com or Corey'sDigs.com if you want to sign up for the Solution Series. And we do appreciate David Dubine being here today with us. Corey, is there anything that you wanted to say before we go ahead and close out the interview?
No, it was great to finally meet you. I appreciate you coming on and sharing a wealth of information, and we'll definitely have to keep in touch.
Yeah, we'll do out here in East Tennessee. Oh, and one thing, we are building a series of 12-foot tall yurts and
Ooh.
putting foundations on there and having wood decking all around it. So other people who do want to come out and work and stay on the farm will have a place to stay and their own glamping yurt. And so, it might sound all fancy like a glamping yurt, but it's really nice and spacious. And you own fire pits and a little septic out there, little showers, these sort of things next to them. So if you come out and work, come to the main house and eat, enjoy, and then you can blaze off and have your own space in the forest or out in one of the part of the fields there. So that's our next movement. So we're trying to think about them making this a full community here for A, it's going to be a pullback spot. If something drastic happens, this is I'll put out the information on how people can get here. But on a daily, we're trying to turn it into something magical and special to, bring harmony back to us within the ecosystem that provides back for us.
That's awesome. Sign me up. I've always wanted to stay in a yurt.
Me too. Well, we'll leave it at that, folks. We're just out of time here. We want to thank our guest, David Debine, from the Adapt 2030 YouTube channel, and check him out on all those different platforms. And of course, for my co-host, Corey Lynn, I'm James White for the Solution Series, saying bye now.